Item 9. From Corporation Counsel submitting an informational monthly report providing an update on the status of pending litigation. This item is also considered by the Committee on Finance, Personnel, and Audit and is informational only unless otherwise directed by the committee.
Attorney Grady.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just passed out the court decision, which, as you can see, was dated a couple days ago. We actually just received it yesterday. In the Rice versus Dmitrievich open meetings case. The bottom line is the court dismissed the case found no violations. This case, originally I was handling it myself, but we decided because I was probably a potential witness in this case that it should go to outside counsel, so it was handled by attorney Andrew Phillips of Phillips and Borowski through the Mutual. And he filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings, and the court issued his decision earlier this week granting that motion. I'm going to probably email this to the full Board of Supervisors because obviously the Finance Committee, who was involved in this issue, would like to have it, and they'll get it next week as well. But I didn't have it time to do it by an email, so I brought paper copies down. Is obviously subject to appeal. I don't know whether they will appeal or not. And obviously, if they will keep you advised whether or not an appeal is filed. I can talk about details if you want, or just leave it with the victory as it stands.
All right, so this is Joe Rice, the former supervisor who brought the suit.
Yes.
All right, thanks.
This, just to be clear, this relates to two primary issues. One relates to county board supervisors going to Madison to provide testimony on what became Act 14. And then the second issue had to do with the closed session of the Finance Committee that related to collective bargaining following Act 10. I think this was April of 2013, I believe, the meeting. And the court found there were no violations in either instance.
Set forth in the pleadings demonstrate that the cause of action is insufficient as a matter of law, judgment. What's the definition of frivolous? I mean, how do we define that it's for it to have been thrown out at such an early stage in the process?
I don't have the definition right in front of me, but it's essentially that there's no reasonable basis in fact or law for the arguments that made. So either you have no factual support for what you said, or the legal argument you made is contrary to the law as it already exists, and it's not even a good faith extension or modification to the law as it exists. And obviously every time a party loses, it doesn't make their defense or their claim frivolous. That's what lawsuits are about. Somebody always loses. But We did not file a frivolous motion claim in this case, a frivolous lawsuit claim in this case.
In this case, they asserted numerous accusations, none of which were held up to go to proceed. I guess that just...
Well, it has to go with the interpretation of the law, and their argument was that because a majority of the county board attended the Madison hearing and it was a subject over which the county board had taken some action with respect to its own local reforms, that is clearly something over which the county board had authority and a power to act. The court said, well, whether that's true or not, the county board had no authority over Act 14 and the passage of Act 14, and therefore it wasn't a meeting of the county board to discuss, to go to Madison and testify in front of the legislature on Act 14. And the other provisions on the closed session, the court felt that our compliance with the open meetings law may not have been perfect, but it substantively gave the public what was required by the law.
Well,
Well, I don't know if we mentioned the plaintiff particularly, but we did inform the court that this was the same notice that had been used for many years, and we did rely on that fact. The part of the way it works, and it's a procedural nicety as a lawyer, that this kind of a motion that was filed by us prevents either side from pulling things outside of the record into the case. So it's based solely on the complaints of the plaintiff and the exhibits attached to the complaint and nothing else. A summary judgment motion, which could have been the next step had we lost this motion, then both sides can bring outside evidence and exhibits and that kind of thing into the case. In fact, at one point on the Finance Committee closed session, the plaintiffs wanted to point to the video of the meeting, and the court said, I can't look at the video. This is a motion based solely on the complaint and the exhibits, and so for this motion, I can't look at the video, and I'm not going to look at the video. So it's not based on outside facts. It's only the facts that are in the complaint and the exhibits attached to the complaint, which were the notices.
Well, I will read this, and because I didn't go near the, I didn't get near the courtroom for this, so I will read this and see what it says. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would take the opportunity, if you read it, to notice the procedure, and it. I know it gets kind of, it seems trivial because you guys do it in every committee, or not every committee, but quite often in committees, and to deal with a closed session. But there is a real formality that's required, and that as we did for the prior items, that, you know, the items be announced, that they be identified specifically enough in the agenda, that the motion be made and identify which items are going into closed session, that the chair then announce the closed session for those purposes, and the courts really look to that formality. And I know it gets kind of old sometimes that we do it that way, but it is required. And with respect to this particular committee meeting that was involved, the court found that maybe we weren't perfect in the way we handled it, but we essentially crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's in one fashion or another. Well, and again, that's why I couldn't handle this case, because I was at the table at finance saying what you're doing is fine. In fact, I think at the time I made a joke about it, but it was at the time when the new Pope had been named, and I said something like, "I'm not the Pope, but I bless you're going into closed session." And so it was a little less formal, maybe.
No smoke.
Well, with respect to the rest of the report, I really don't have any news. There's no new decisions, no new, really no news to report on anything else. I did add item 18 at the chair's request, Chairman Liskin's request, and this is a lawsuit filed by the administration, basically through our office, to challenge the PRB's exercise of jurisdiction over hearing disciplinary grievances. And the PRB believes that they have the authority under the ordinance to hear disciplinary grievances. Our office, and this actually goes back to the creation of the PRB, issued an opinion back in the 60s or 70s that they didn't have that authority, and so we're just trying to stand by our prior opinion from 40 or 50 years ago.
Just one question. Thank you. Could you just explain, I guess, who gets to start the lawsuit? I'm just looking at this, and it's, you know, the county exec appoints these people to one board, and, you know, back and forth. It's just strange to me. And then he then authorizes. Is he fighting with himself here? And then he authorizes a lawsuit by himself. Could you explain some of that?
Yeah, sure. Chairman, supervisors, there was an amendment to Chapter 1 of the ordinances when the other amendments were done a couple of years ago, and that amendment says that lawsuits by the county that involve more than $10,000 must be approved by the county board, the judiciary committee, I believe, and county board. And this lawsuit is basically a declaration. It involves a suspension over, I think it's a 3 or 5 day, I'm not sure, suspension, but it doesn't involve $10,000. Anything that does involve over $10,000 would come to the board for the Judiciary Committee for approval, unless for some reason it was some sort of an emergency or something, and then there'd be a reporting mechanism. It's authorized, obviously, by the executive on behalf of the department involved, and I can't remember which department this is, but that employs the employee involved. I think it's BHD, but I'm not sure. And it's obviously against the Personnel Review Board, which is relying on their outside counsel to advise them on this issue. And yes, the county executive appoints PRB members subject to confirmation of the county board, and so I suppose in some fashion you can see it as him challenging the authority of appointees of his own, but that's no different than any regular case where we go through the department and represent the department in our office for discharge of employees, and we're appearing in front of this independent body, the Personnel Review Board, and if the PRB refused to discharge someone, and if our office together with the department felt that there was enough authority for a circuit court, enough reason for a circuit court to review that, we would file a similar kind of action, a writ of certiorari review in the circuit court to challenge its decision. I mean, employees do that all the time when they get discharged. Then they file a certiorari review in circuit court. It'd be the converse. We don't do it very often, but at times we've done it. And now, I don't know in any given discharge case whether it would be more or less than $10,000. I guess it depends on how you look at it. But in the past, anyway, before Chapter 1 was amended, we would file those on selected occasions on behalf of a department head if they wanted to challenge a non-discharge of an employee.
Well, I guess my question on the $10,000 mark, how are we calculating that? Because these things take a lot of time, a lot of your time. I'd like to know how we calculate that $10,000 mark, because I don't think we had this type of stuff in mind when that change was made.
Chairman Supervisors, I think you're correct that nobody anticipated this particular kind of case when that change was made. The $10,000, I believe, was chosen. Supervisor Jurczyk was the sponsor, but I believe it was chosen to match the $10,000 statutory limit of authority of this committee. This committee can settle claims up to $10,000 without board approval. It's the final approval. And so this matches that authority. And that process, when we look at settling a claim, it's basically how much are we paying out. So no matter what we're doing, it's how much we're paying out. It does not include our defense costs or anything like that. So by the converse, in this situation, I would say the $10,000 is measured by what are the damages being claimed, what are we at risk to pay the other party. It's not inclusive. It doesn't include our time or our attorney's fees to pursue the action. And so it's the amount that's at stake in the action in terms of the claim.
Well, maybe we'll have to revisit that, because I'm sure there's plenty of other things that you'd rather spend your time on than this. So.
Well, on this particular item, I think we do want to spend our time on it, because we believe that the PRB is acting contrary to not only the advice we gave the county board when it created the PRB, but I believe what the county board did when it created the PRB. And just real briefly on that,
right,
that when the PRB was created, it included the review of disciplinary suspensions at the original draft. And our office, I don't remember who, back in the day, wrote an opinion and said you can't do that because of state statute. And so the ordinance that was proposed was amended to take that out. And so the PRB now is exercising the jurisdiction because they think there's I'm not sure exactly why they think they have the authority, but we believe that if you look at the legislative history of the PRB, it's clear that they don't have that authority.
Well, it's just that you seem to, this is clearly you're talking about county board actions and county board policies, yet no one asked me if I wanted to go to court on these things, and that's where I think there's a line that's been crossed, and I think part of this has to do with you know, a lot of this less than 10 days was always handled in a contract situation, and now you have an executive branch who doesn't want to recognize a contract, but then they want to cherry pick things on, you know, what applies and what doesn't. So that's I just have a problem that, you know, this is a policy issue, and it seems to be being held somehow off in the distance rather than incorporating the board in it.
Mr. Chairman, Supervisors, two responses to the broader issue and then the specific issue. One is, certainly if you want to amend Chapter 1 to clarify the authority here, it's your right, it's your responsibility to do that. Clearly, there is some ambiguity here because when the amendment was done, I don't think anyone anticipated this type of a lawsuit, which is more of a lawsuit on principle than it is a lawsuit on dollars. And so it's clear that there's a gap in Chapter 1 on this issue. I think it allowed us to do this, but if you want to change that, that's your prerogative. And the more things are clear, the easier it makes my job. So that's fine. On the specific issue, it is an Act 10 fallout that before Act 10, most of the collective bargaining agreements allowed employees in those bargaining unions to grieve these types of suspensions because the state law, Chapter 111, allowed that. But even when we had those unions, non-represented employees did not have that option. They, in our opinion, they couldn't go to the PRB and grieve a less than 10-day suspension. What obviously happened with Act 10 is those collective bargaining rights disappeared. And because those disappeared, for this purpose at least, all of our employees, except for public safety, are effectively treated like non-represented. And so they're treated now the same way as everyone else used to be treated, and they have no right to review a less than 10-day suspension. That comes from state statute. If somebody changes the state statute, you know, fine, but that's where it comes from. It comes from the creation of the civil service system, in fact, when it was originally created. It said basically, we're going to have civil service, and we're going to have civil service commission review discharges or double suspensions, you know, 2 and less than 6 months. But nothing in the civil service system shall prohibit a department head from suspending an employee for 10 days or less. And that's been there for a long time.
Yeah, I just, Chairman and Supervisors, just want to, first of all, echo everything that Mark said. And when this issue came up, you know, first of all, it was a bunch of lawyers in our office that talked about this. The decision to us didn't make any sense, didn't have a proper legal basis, didn't make sense for our clients, who are the departments and the people who are administering our workforce, for them to have to start to try to live with this, and it just wasn't right. And when lawyers are faced with something they don't think is right, they appeal it. It had nothing to do with going to the executive and saying, do you want to do this or don't you want to do this? We all just agreed as a matter of law that this was not what we thought the law was, not what we thought the procedures would be, and not what we thought our departments had been operating under for all these years, or at least, you know, since the Act 10 changes. So that's kind of the genesis of the decision. I think it's just a decision that I'm not sure where it came from. I don't know where the PRB got this, and we're trying to get the judge to clarify it. Maybe the judge will tell us where they got it, and maybe we'll be wrong. We expect a decision pretty soon. So. In the meantime, the PRB has agreed not to take any more of these cases until the judge rules, so at least the status quo is preserved. So.
All right. Seeing no other business,